Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:33 p.m. and today is February 1st, 2023. Present today at the committee table, we have Co-Chair Johnson, Co-Chair Foster. We have members Cologne, Kronk, Tomaszewski, Josephson, Hannon, Galvin, Stapp, myself, Co-Chair Edgman. I think we'll be joined shortly by Representative Ortiz. As usual, the reminder to silence cell phones, if you would, please. And we'd like to thank our moderator, Emma Turner from the LIO, and our Finance Secretary, Bree Wiley, who is already reminding me that I need to actually get closer to the microphone. Today, we're hearing a presentation on deferred maintenance for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities from Neil Steininger, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. We commonly refer to OMB. And Jason Sakalakis, who is the Facilities Services Director for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And we're also going to hear a presentation from the University of Alaska on their deferred maintenance projects from Sarah Perman. She's the Government Relations Manager for the University. And at this time, Director Steininger, if you and Director Sakalakis could please come forward and introduce yourself and any staff that you might have accompanying us. I guess maybe, I presume we have staff online. You might make a mention of that as well. I'm not seeing any business before the committee. If you would start your presentation, please.
For the record, Neil Steininger, Director of the Office of Management and Budget.
Jason Sakalakis, Director of Statewide Public Facilities for Department of Transportation.
So to start, just a general definition of deferred maintenance. So deferred maintenance is maintenance or repair projects that have been delayed or postponed, either due to lack of funds or lack of time and ability to achieve within an entity's normal operating budget. So on the state level, each department that has responsibility for a facility or, you know, tenancy in a facility generally has money in their operating budget to achieve routine maintenance. But oftentimes projects may be too large in scope or get put off as a result of short funding within that operating maintenance allocation in the agency's budget, and then it becomes what we call deferred maintenance and moves to a backlog list. So the state of Alaska has 2,400 facilities, or greater than 2,400 facilities. They're spread out across pretty much every agency, and that number includes the university, who has a very large proportion of the state facilities. Across those facilities, we have about 20 million square feet of space. And the type of those facilities really varies agency to agency, and that results in much different needs for each agency's facilities. So when we're talking about these facilities, you know, one is this Capitol building here, but we also can be talking about, you know, a remote cabin for field workers for the Department of Fish and Game, or, you know, an office building housing office workers. And each of those, you know, depending upon the age, the use of the building, or the location, would have very different needs in terms of ongoing or, you know, recurring or deferred maintenance.
If I might be the first to actually pose a question or make a statement, the deferred maintenance category and the list itself doesn't include K through 12 schools, public schools. Is that correct?
Chair Edgman, that is correct. So our list just includes state-owned facilities. So the only school, other than the university system, the only school you would see there would be Mount Edgecombe.
Okay, thank you.
So generally speaking, there's no definitive rule on the amount of funding that you need to put in to, you know, keep a building healthy and in good repair. There is, you know, a handful of different guidelines out there, or there are a handful of different guidelines out there. One that we generally reference to is a 2012 National Research Council publication. They reference a range of 2 to 4% of the replacement value of the buildings as an amount recommended to spend on an annual basis for maintenance. When you look at the fiscal year 21 replacement cost value, this excludes the university, so just state-owned facilities outside of the UA system. We have about $7.7 billion in total replacement value of our facilities. So if you extend that to the 2 to 4% range, you're looking at about $150 to $310 million in a funding range. Sometimes 1% is thrown out as another benchmark number. You can see that here would be about $77 million. And that comes from kind of other publications other than that National Research Council publication.
Let the record reflect that we've been joined by Representative Ortiz. Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Chair Edgman, and through the chair. Mr. Steinhardt, annually I have seen a report that's done by, and because I can't remember their formal name, but it's professional engineers in the state to do a report card on public facilities and maintenance and give us a letter grade, A through F, as to where we are. Being that they're engineers, I assume that there is a formulaic computation that they do about the cost, and I know that you come from the financial side, but I don't know, does that information, do they ever draw from OMB as what we're doing on it? You know, but you've seen the report where we got an, it's never had an A. It's usually C's and D's on our maintenance, and wondering from differing from the financial lens of 2 to 4% what the Engineers Association uses for grading the maintenance of our facilities.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I'm not familiar with this specific report. They might be using some of the data that we post publicly. I'm just not aware if they've asked us for input, and you know, we can take a look at that report and get back to you.
Thank you. And through the, one follow-up. I'm sure as a teacher hoarder, I somewhere have those previous reports because they had letter grades, and I will dig one out and let you see it.
And I believe the organization you're talking about is a nationally based organization with grades for every state, is the way I understand it.
Yeah, but the Alaska chapter always comes and says, you know, the Alaska engineers have said, here's where we are in our facilities.
Continue. Oh, pardon me, question. Representative Tomaszewski.
Thank you, Co-Chair Edgman. Through the chair, Mr. Steininger. On the previous slide, you included the university and the number of facilities, but then on this particular slide we're on, you're excluding the university. What's the purpose on that?
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, the purpose of that is we simply just didn't have the data for this slide, and you know, the university's maintenance generally is budgeted for a little bit separately in the university, and they do have their own presentation to give on, you know, referencing their, you know, their facilities. The previous slide was just trying to give an idea of, you know, the overall value. Most of my slides from here on out will be limited just to, you know, the core executive branch, excluding the university, though.
Okay, thank you.
So slide four is detailing the amount of funding for maintenance, both deferred maintenance and ongoing operating maintenance in the fiscal year 24 budget. You can see in the capital budget itself, there's about $35 million spread across statewide deferred maintenance, court system maintenance, a project in correctional facilities for doors and windows, as well as some fish and game projects for maintenance of their owned assets. And then in the operating budget, when you add all of the state agencies, excluding the university, together with their maintenance and operating allocations within the budget, you get about $77.8 million. And that totals to $112.6 across those two budgets in fiscal year 24. When you compare that to the previous slide, you can see we're greater than that 1% benchmark, but we do fall short of that 2 to 4% range.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you, Chair Edgman. I have a question through the chair for Director Steininger. I'm wondering about why there is a separation, if that's the norm for other states as well, when the university, so I'm questioning separating out the university from the rest of the facilities in the state, and if that's a normal activity budgetary-wise.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I'm not sure if it's a normal activity for every state to have their university budget sort of a little bit unique from the rest of the operating and capital budgets. In the state of Alaska, you know, the university budget is a recommendation from the Board of Regents that's a little bit, you know, independent from, you know, the governor's budget process. We then include certain aspects of their budget recommendation, but we generally allow the university to speak to their budget requests separately from the rest of the state's budget requests, just as kind of respect for that Board of Regents process.
Yes, through the chair. The governor made a choice then to, and it's just, I assume this is historically typical in Alaska, where we've split them because the Regents wants to make their own ask for their own needs. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, there, you know, the university is included in the governor's budget.
Yes.
When we're looking at what is, so generally speaking, when we're looking at what's under the purview of the Division of Facilities Services at DOT, and what we're generally looking at in the statewide deferred maintenance appropriations, we tend to be looking at the state facilities under the management of the Department of or the Division of Facilities Services, and those don't include the university. The university has their own, you know, structure for maintenance activities and things of that nature. I will put a caveat on that. Within the $30 million in statewide deferred maintenance, we have in many previous years provided a portion of that funding and allocated it off to the university, not generally for specific projects, but just when they've not received a direct appropriation through the budget process. We generally provide them with some funding out of that pot of money to ensure they can meet their highest needs. So there is some gray area between there, but the Division of Facilities Services doesn't maintain any of their buildings.
Follow up.
Okay, so just I want to make sure I have this clear. It makes sense in that they have their own maintenance department and they're tighter with that as opposed to the state with all of its other maintenance programs, but there's no doubt or question around the united approach to make sure that all of our facilities are maintained. There's no sense that there's valuing one over another. It's just separating them for the sake of better communication about each. Is that what I'm hearing?
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, generally speaking, yes. Yes.
Thank you.
Representative Josephson.
Through the chair. Mr. Steininger, I don't want to be, my intent is not to be adversarial, but in the slightest, but you said something that struck me as not entirely accurate. Or perhaps it forgot something, or maybe I've forgotten something. But you mentioned the statewide deferred maintenance. You said, moments ago, you said, well, sometimes we give some of that to university if there wasn't an appropriation. I guess my concern and my memory is that the legislature writ large has eagerly wanted to provide university system deferred maintenance, but the governor has typically vetoed all or some of that. Isn't that a little more accurate as to what's happened?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, you are correct that in prior years there have been maintenance projects appropriated to the university by the legislature that were vetoed by the governor. And in some of those years, we have taken a portion of the statewide deferred maintenance and provided part of it to the university. So it's, you know, still at the end of the day, the final appropriation made did not include a maintenance appropriation for the university. And so we worked through this statewide deferred maintenance pot. Not in every year does that happen, but it has happened in the past.
Seeing no additional questions, Director Steininger. Did you have a question? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Ortiz had a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, through the chair. Mr. Steiniger. I perhaps, you know, I was late, and so I might have missed the thing that I'm going to ask about, and I apologize for that if that's the case. But when you say that, you know, you point out that if the figure of $112 million gets us a little bit more than the 1%, but falls short of the 2% and 4% value, in your time that you've been within this particular job, have you seen the figures? When we don't address the issues now, does it cause even greater numbers and even greater significant growth in those numbers if we don't address them here and now? Does that make sense what I'm saying? Is there an opportunity cost of, while we might be collectively okay with just achieving 1% or a little greater than 1% this year, down the road, is that going to cause more problems for us? Let's put it that way.
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, we've certainly seen growth in the deferred maintenance backlogs over time, especially since the years where we have very large appropriations for maintenance, you know, roughly a decade ago. I would say that in my time in this role, you know, I've seen efforts to dispose of state assets we no longer need, which that helps to kind of work away from that replacement value total amount. But in that time, you also see then the replacement value of those existing buildings appreciating as well. So, you know, kind of the point of the juxtaposition of these two slides is to note that really as a result of, you know, kind of a lack of resources at a statewide level, we are funding building maintenance as much as we're able to, but maybe not as much as we should. And the strategy to address that, you know, is not just funding, but also looking at, you know, are all the facilities that we have ones that are still meeting the need of the state? As we look at, you know, change in workforce, is there ways that we can reduce footprint? Are there ways that we can address the backlog through more than just putting money into some of these projects? But it is, you know, I think there's a good reason why this is a full hearing all on its own, because we have a fairly large amount of buildings. This is a need to be addressed. You know, this is a basically the means we have to address it. So how do we best, you know, allocate those means as best as we can to address the highest priority projects? And, you know, that's kind of alluding to some of the discussion that Director Sakalakis will have a little bit later in these slides.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Johnson.
Yeah, thank you. And through the chair to the director, so I see up there on the fourth line down, it says fishing game, vessel, and aircraft deferred maintenance. Is that the only department that has vessels? I mean, is vessels and aircraft, I mean, we aren't going to have, say, I mean, maybe there is. Is there like DOT deferred maintenance in, as far as vehicles? Or is it usual to have something that's not like a building or a, is it typical to have equipment in there?
Chair Johnson, so I would say actually we probably could have also included the Marine Highway System vessel maintenance as deferred maintenance of a significant asset onto this table. And, you know, to be honest, probably should have included that as well, because it kind of fits the same definition there as a fish and game vessel and aircraft. When you look at maintenance, you know, commonly we generally are thinking of buildings most of the time. But we also have some significant assets, like some of those fish and game vessels, a couple of vessels in the Department of Public Safety, as well as, you know, the Marine Highway System vessels as well.
Follow up. Thank you. Through the chair, I just have a question on page 5. Should that be FY24 on that call? Or I guess it's on the screen. Should that have an FY24 column?
Chair Johnson, actually, this is representing the distributions we've made of the prior year appropriations. So for fiscal year 24 that we've proposed in the capital budget this year, we won't make those distributions until that appropriation is made. So slide 5 here is showing the amounts by agency of distributions of the statewide deferred maintenance appropriations since we started appropriating deferred maintenance at a statewide level rather than by individual facility. And that really in fiscal year 18 is when the process that Director Sakalakis and I will be talking about through this presentation, when that process started, where we tried to get a handle on a statewide view of deferred maintenance rather than making appropriations to individual agencies. And really the reason for that is prior to fiscal year 18, we saw that a lot of, there were a lot of facilities in the state that didn't necessarily receive appropriations for maintenance on a consistent basis. A lot of those appropriations were made, for good cause to, significant facilities, whether it's a correctional institution or a pioneer home. But then we'd see places where, say, a office building or a lab might not be receiving deferred maintenance appropriations and significant problems could build up. And so that's why back in that year, this was proposed to move to a statewide level so that while we still prioritize things like a pioneer home or a correctional institution where there's a life health safety aspect, we can still use that flexibility to address something like a public health lab or something of that nature that may have an emergent need. So this chart shows you where we've made those distributions over time. Here you can also see where in those years where we've made distributions to the university system. And you can also see that there is a portion of money unobligated out of the fiscal year 23 appropriation. And the reason for that is as we were making our distributions in 23, we started to see some of the trends on things like cost of steel, cost of lumber, and other inputs into the construction industry. And we are, expecting that some of these projects funded in the previous 2 years, might come back with overages. So we held back a little bit reserved out of that distribution to address cost overruns in projects.
Hello?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So just for clarification then through the chair, distribution comes after the later on there'll be a determination on what a distribution will be depending on need and so on. Okay.
Great. So just as a follow-up, last year in the FY23 budget, I think the legislature in total appropriated $250 million for the three big categories, deferred maintenance, school major maintenance, which isn't included on that. And then it was a $50 million for the university, if I remember right, something like that. So let's say it's $150 if you take out public schools. And FY23, the number you have there is $27 million. Was that part of the reasoning for making those vetoes from, for $100 million for deferred maintenance and $50 million for the university? Was, as you were just saying, sort of a carrying capacity issue out there, if you will, in terms of supply chain, workforce, the ability to get projects done on time?
Chair Edgman, you have a little bit of that carrying capacity ability to actually get work done on time. The preference here with these deferred maintenance distributions is to see projects that can be executed on immediately so that we can, address the facility maintenance needs that can be addressed as quickly as possible and, fix those issues and get the money deployed. Another portion of that, veto decision really had to do with ensuring that enough money was put into savings to hold savings forward for a potential decline in oil prices.
And I think it's worth bringing sort of that context before the committee, knowing that and not to highlight the fact that vetoes are made because that's prerogative of the governor. Every governor generally makes vetoes, each budget cycle, but that of the governor's $400+ million vetoes, a good chunk of it came from deferred maintenance. So just to put that side by side with the importance of this issue, $7 billion in deferred maintenance out there, it's a growing list. But at the same time, if the legislature appropriates the money in a significant manner, going back to your 1% or your 2%, what happens on the back end? And so I want to put that forward again, not to make a pointed comment, but just to put it out there that we have a pretty significant issue. A lot of buildings in Alaska, a lot of infrastructure are aged. Now go back 40, 50, 60 years, perhaps even pre-statehood in some instances, the university, for example. And we have let deferred maintenance lapse during the period of the 90s when oil was in the single digits because we didn't barely have enough money to even provide for the operating functions of state government, much less provide for deferred maintenance, something that could accumulate over time. But I think it's important for, we have new members on the committee as well as some returning members, but to put that into its rightful context. Here we are discussing the importance of it, but then down the road, we may not be able to get the funding to it. Continue, please.
So slide six, again, this slide is excluding the university. It just represents the facilities under management of the Division of Facility Services. Our backlog is $703.5 million in deferred maintenance projects. You can see here the vast majority of them are in the Department of Transportation in terms of dollar value. Later slide in the appendix, you'll see why, and that's because the Department of Transportation has the vast majority of the facilities under management. You can see also the Department of Corrections, Natural Resources also have fairly large backlogs. That second DOT and PF bar is for the PBF, the Public Building Fund. The Public Building Fund is separated from the main DOT bar as it represents the primarily state office buildings, like the state office building here in Juneau or the Atwood building up in Anchorage. Those buildings are all managed together under a single fund, and it's managed a little bit differently in terms of the finances and some federal rules with how we manage the rates for effectively leasing that those buildings back to state agencies. And here on slide seven, I'm going to hand it over to Director Sakalakis. The statewide funding approach really is a cooperation between the Division of Facility Services and the Office of Management and Budget, and he'll go into some detail on how we manage that.
All right. Thank you, Neil. Appreciate it. Again, Jason Sakalakis, Northern Region Public Facilities Director, for record. So what I'll be covering here real quick is basically going over how we actually acquire a deferred maintenance list of needs and then how we prioritize those for further review and funding. So first of all, like Neil said, it's a collaborative effort between OMB and Department of Public Facilities, and OMB works to basically identify and collect the deferred maintenance needs across all executive branch agencies. From there, the Statewide Public Facilities Council meets and prioritizes these projects. The Statewide Public Facilities Council is made up from executive branch members across all agencies. They normally meet about this time every year from February to May to prioritize the identified needs with a goal to provide OMB a prioritized list in June to move forward with project delivery. Project prioritization is based upon significant factors, primarily the facility's importance, building systems within the building for it to deliver its service, and then also the urgency of the project. Each of those factors then used to develop a project index value, which we call it, which actually scores the project. So to step down into the formula here a little bit and go through the process, basically, like I said, we have a mission alignment index, and that's really the alignment of the facility to the agency's mission, so the importance of the building to the agency itself. There's a system factor. This is where we're looking at the building systems within the building structure and what kind of impacts they may have on the building operations. And then you have the need, which is obviously the urgency of the project that's submitted. As I said, we meet as a council, so there's active discussions throughout this process. There's multiple meetings between February and May as part of this process. And there are other attributes that are sometimes considered. Some of the things that we've seen through prior coordination is basically looking at return on investment has been object of discussion. Basically any matching funds that's available for the projects too. And then along with eligibility as finance energy savings performance projects.
Question, Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chairman Edgman. Through the chair, Mr. Sakalakis, I've got a very specific project that used to be in my district but no longer is in mind, and it's one of those where I can't get an explanation. So DOT's maintenance building in Haines leaks, is noncompliant with electrical, can't meet snow load needs. The break room was no longer usable because the plumbing and sewage backed up, yet it hasn't risen up to the project maintenance level to be a significant project. When I look at your matrix, I go, mission critical, it's where every piece of equipment is stored, including the computers that get bagged every day because of the leakage. Oh, and unplugged from the walls because of the electrical. System factor, I am sure that every plow driver needs to be able to check their equipment, et cetera. This is my fifth year in, and it was in that state when I first got elected and has not yet risen to the level of we should do something about the building. And it's a little building. I'm sure it's not millions of dollars. So I am also pretty sure that it's not unique across the state, that we've got lots of small buildings that just a few people work out of that are in horrible shape. How do we move that matrix so that we are making sure that our buildings are standing, our equipment is secured, and the delivery of the service for the maintenance guys there for both airport maintenance, plow maintenance, the trooper that is dispatched out of Haines, all have that equipment accessible to them?
Through the chair, Representative Hannah. I would like to actually take a moment just to actually probably get back with you on the status of that project. But I do know that it is actually an active design status for looking at a building replacement project. I'd have to confirm whether it's in the capital budget or not. I don't know if Neil can speak to that at this time, but I do know it's high on our priority list for working through to understand what's needed to actually potentially replace that facility. So it's a little bit beyond maybe a deferred maintenance need. But
thank you. Through the chair, the one follow-up. Great. I am glad to hear that, because that was my conclusion from a non-engineer is, how do you maintain this? This looks like a condemnable building. So maybe that's the answer. We're going to build a new one. Thank you.
Continue.
So further looking at the emission alignment index factor there. So basically, as I stated, the emission alignment index is the importance of the facility to the agency for completing their mission. Besides looking how critical it is to the agency's mission, it also takes into account basically if is it capable to deliver the service needed, how is it being utilized, in other words, how many people or how many services is it delivering, and then also the location to see if there's any other facilities within that location that may be able to deliver that need if there was an issue with that facility. We feel that looking at the mission alignment index factor allows us to better look at risk management in the program and guides an investor divestiture decisions. And one special note with the mission alignment index, which I'll go into a little bit later, but this is determined solely by the agency that occupies the building. So they get the sole input on determining the rating factor for the mission alignment index, which you'll see here a little bit further in the presentation. So the mission alignment index is broke down into kind of critical, important, supportive, and what we'll say is other or non-mission critical. A couple examples of those facilities would be like a critical facility would be maybe a key maintenance station, a correctional center, a school, etc. Important, maybe certain office buildings. And for a supportive or maybe a non-mission critical, we'll be looking at examples of like certain warehouses or storage facilities. The other key factors that I mentioned earlier were basically the building facility systems and the need of the project. We look at the systems first with a highest priority of life, health, and safety. Some of the facilities or some of the systems within the facility that deal with life, health, safety clearly are the sprinkler, fire alarm, structural, etc. We also review the envelope and shell, roof, exterior walls, and windows. Mechanical systems, you know, your HVAC, plumbing, electrical, and then your interior and exterior facilities, or run facilities, so interior doors, walls, furnishings, those kind of things. The need is identified into three categories, which is critical, important, and necessary. The definition of critical is life, health, safety, again, looking at or any code hazards that may be present. Important, really what we classify that as need an action within the next 5 years to prevent any further deterioration. And then necessary is required attention to continue any type or prevent any type of deterioration or downtime of the facility. So some examples of the last prioritization cycle. Here's where you see what is kind of provided to OMB as a prioritized list. These are examples taken from last year. And as you can see, as I mentioned, the Mission Alignment Index is determined by the department for which owns the facility. And as you can see, it's a critical, these ones were critical essential buildings to deliver the service of that department. As I said before, this factor is the sole determination of the agency that occupies the building. Unlike the system factor in need, that is scored across the committee, and an average is taken for those scorings to then reach your project index value and overall ranking. So that lets an agency weight their input with regards to the building importance, but then allows the committee to score a couple other factors as presented. And then of special note, I'd like to say that through the last year's process of scoring projects, the Facilities Council scored more than 100 projects and provided those ranking and scorings.
So. Question from Representative Galvin.
Thank you, through the chair. I do have a question, and it may be one for both of you. In hearing stories and about what happened in Haines and what happened with there was a storage facility, I believe, and then learning about your ranking and such, I wondered more about the routine maintenance that's already in the budget and whether there's a sense that that is high enough to help make sure that we don't slip to the higher need of this deferred maintenance that we're hearing about in your presentation. In other words, apparently there's some things going on, like basic, sounded pretty basic to me, that's clearing snow from the roof and things like that. I just wondered if there is if you've evaluated that part of it, that routine maintenance piece, and whether we have the appropriate amount there to keep us from getting to this stage.
Again, for the record, Neil Sanger, Office of Management and Budget, and I'll take a piece of this question, and maybe Jason can fill in some more. So through the chair, Representative Galvin, one of the reasons that we moved to Division of Facility Services and centralized a lot of this activity is we did see disparity between different agencies in ongoing operating maintenance. As we've gone through, you know, years of budget constraint, you know, agencies have to make pragmatic decisions and work with Office of Management and Budget and the Office of the Governor to make pragmatic decisions on limited resources. And sometimes, you know, facilities maintenance versus, you know, ensuring that a social worker is going out to see a child can be a challenging decision to make. So there are definitely some areas where we saw deficiencies there. That's kind of the process that we're trying to work through with the Division of Facility Services. It is an ongoing process. As we look at some of these deferred maintenance projects that do come up, that do raise up in the list, generally speaking, each year we see one or two that we look at and at OMB say, well, this is something that probably should be able to be achieved in ongoing operating maintenance. And then we have that conversation with the given agency. So it is a bit of a mixed bag. It is a prioritization issue that we have to confront on a pretty routine basis.
Okay. Very good. Additional questions? Not seeing any. Representative Ortiz, did you have your hand up? Okay. Continue.
Okay, and then kind of to round out the discussion is once projects are actually decided, ranked, scored, and funded, we actually go through overall the process of normally each project has a planning, design, and construction phase to it. Each of these phases can be in different lengths depending upon the size of the project or the complexity and scope of the project. Most projects offer local and statewide design professionals and associated construction contractors opportunity through the state procurement process. One thing I'd like to note is, you know, our typical project cost impacts, which Neil kind of referenced before, can include, you know, market value contracting, commodity price increases, and or scope increases if there are unforeseen or unknown conditions or hazard present in the process. Basically, projects can come in under or over engineer's estimates. We have seen projects come in excess of anywhere from 65 to over 100% of engineer's estimates. The reason why we present that here today is because, again, I want to go back to the conversation that we are meeting as a facilities council, and that in these discussions, we're bringing up these kind of overruns and things that we are seeing and having active discussions on those as we're scoring projects. So we're trying to get a full circle loop back to the facilities council so that way when we're scoring projects, we're providing information to OMB, it's accurate for project delivery.
And that's actually a bigger piece in the entire puzzle these days, right, with inflation and increased costs and, again, supply chain issues. And because you can have something that scores really high, but then if you put it in the budget knowing that there could be a 20% add-on in a year or two or so, that has to be a consideration. And, you know, it just seems to me, and that's a consideration with school districts, which aren't a part of this conversation, getting a maintenance project. I have one in my district where a year later, it was like a quarter more than what they budgeted for. So they came back to the state and were unable to get that additional funding for it, had to scrounge around locally and somehow come up with the funding, but definitely consideration. Thank you.
And the following slides are appendixes for just informational purposes. So the first here is the state-owned facilities count by agency. This includes the university here. You can see, as I had alluded to earlier, Department of Transportation has a large number of facilities, which results in their backlog being much greater compared to the other agencies when you exclude the university. But then slide 16, this is square feet of facilities. And here you can see where while the university had about half as many buildings as DOT, has significantly more in square footage, which really drives some of those deferred maintenance needs and that backlog in the university.
A question from Representative Hennen.
Thank you, through the chair. So I'm just curious on that count by state-owned facilities. The governor's office, it shows, owns three facilities. So could you tell me what those are? Governor's House.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, there's the governor's residence, the, I'm drawing a blank on the name of the building, but it's kitty corner from the Capitol here, that residence.
The Lieutenant Governor's House.
The Lieutenant Governor's House and the CERD facility. I'd have to get back to you on what that CERD facility is unless.
Yeah, because I was thinking all the offices are public facilities buildings. Mm-hmm. So that's 2 of 3. Thank you.
So I'll get back to you as a cert.
The governor's vote.
And so the final slide, slide 17, I'd kind of alluded to this in an earlier answer to a question. The state has been working to dispose of assets that are no longer needed. Here you can see a list of historical disposed assets over the last several years. And we continue to look at, you know, need for an asset and the ability to dispose of that asset if it's something that's no longer necessary for the mission of an agency.
Do we know in the Federal Infrastructure Act, and I don't remember there being any monies that were allocated towards deferred maintenance. I mean, have you since last year learned more about that, or is there any at all?
Through the chair, Representative Edgman, none that I know of that specifically would go to just doing deferred maintenance of a state facility. However, there are, you know, some areas where we might be able to leverage a program out of the infrastructure bill to do a replacement of a facility, or, you know, find a way to address and, you know, remove some of that backlog, you know, in the course of operating on another project.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you. Through Chair Edgman. Mr. Steinacker, when you're looking at the third facility that the governor's office is attributed to owning, I think there's I'm hoping you will also, on this square footage file, it actually shows it as identical square footage to ADF&G facilities of 651,321 square feet, which I suspect is an error in just duplicating because the two residences can't, I mean, there's either some big building somewhere that's hidden or that square footage is off, but I was trying to deduce what our third facility was and went, I think there's an error. So if you would find out for me what that one is.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, yes, that looks like an error to me as well.
Representative Josephson.
Does the 10-year outlook ever use the more ambitious, for example, 4% of replacement cost value, or does it always use sort of a lower number?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the 10-year outlook, so a significant portion of that money funding deferred maintenance is actually designated general funds. So our 10-year outlook generally just looks at unrestricted general funds. So that portion's not there. It does include, as part of just the general escalation rate on operating and capital budgets, a 1.5% per year escalation, which would apply to some of that operating maintenance as well. But it does not go to that, you know, 4% level. It really is that more constrained level that we've been able to afford now.
Okay, follow up? Just a follow-up. This is not an issue that I necessarily am losing sleep over. Maybe I should, and that is deferred maintenance. I certainly am aware of it. But to me, when I see the total of $77 million and, or rather $112 and $77 is maintenance and operations, that term maintenance operations sounds like an annual continual event. It doesn't sound like the improvement of the problem Representative Hannon identified in Haynes. In other words, can you make the argument that no, indeed, that $77 million is just like the other $35 million? Are we really, and for all I know, every state has the same situation, $700-plus million of deferred maintenance. But they just strike me as different at page 4. Am I right that they're different, or are they part of the same family of expenditures?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, the money in the operating budget for maintenance and operations, you know, it is different than deferred maintenance in the sense of that, you know, definition at the beginning. Deferred maintenance are things that, you know, you ideally should have been able to accommodate within your preventative maintenance and operations budget and your operating budget, but simply couldn't due to a lack of resources, time, what have you. And so they are different in nature, but one, you know, the lack of one does drive the other.
Not seeing any additional comments or questions. I think that's the end of the presentation. Is that correct, Director Steiniger? Well, if that be the case, I'd like to thank you and Director Sakalakis for coming forward. Sakalakis, pardon me. And shift to a second part of our presentation today, if we might. And that is to hear from Ms. Perman, who is the government relations staff with the university. Take a brief at ease. Will the Finance Committee please come back on record? We have before us Ms. Perman, who will give us a presentation on deferred maintenance vis-a-vis the University of Alaska. Welcome, Sarah.
Through the chair, thank you very much for inviting the university to be here today. My name is Sarah Perman, State Relations Manager for the University of Alaska System, which means I represent University of Alaska Anchorage, University of Alaska Fairbanks, the University of Alaska Southeast, and all of our associated community and rural campuses, as well as our system office. With regards to how I interact with you guys, my role is similar to that of a legislative liaison. I'll interact with you with constituent-related issues, but also in the regards that we help walk through the budget process and provide information that you may or may not have regarding the university's operations and capital budgets. With me today on the phone, I believe I have Alicia Kruckenberg, who is the University of Alaska Systems Director of Planning and Budget, Chris McConnell from UAA, he's the Director of Facilities and Campus Services, Cameron Wolford from UAF, he's the Director of Design and Construction, and Nathan Lay from UAS, who's the Director of Facilities and Services. Between our three facilities members, we have any details you might be interested in on individual projects, and then Alicia Kruckenberg, Director Kruckenberg, will be able to walk through any very specific details regarding our budget. I appreciate the robust conversation that included the university with Director Steiniger. I hope that I'm able to answer some of the questions you had about our facilities, the number of our facilities, the budget of our facilities. And with that, I'll just kick off. We have a sizable number of facilities. As you saw, of the 2,400 statewide facilities, we are 394 of them, second only to DOT and public facilities. That includes 7.9 million square feet, which is two times as much as any other agency. And our inflation-adjusted value of those facilities is $4.9 billion, and we have a $1.5 billion backlog. backlog of deferred maintenance. And I think that when you look at the percentage of replacement value that Director Steininger was talking about, we're above and beyond that in terms of our needs for deferred maintenance. We've gotten here over years of we've had fairly consistent funding up through FY13, about $50 million a year, which has helped us maintain and flatline our backlog of deferred maintenance. However, declining budgets over the last several years, maintenance budgets have really skyrocketed that up to $1.5 billion. And I will go into that in the next slide, but I just wanted to talk a little bit about what we're doing currently to try to manage and mitigate the situation. We are using those shrinking maintenance budgets to the most efficient capacity that we can. That's taking a look at which projects within each facility will help extend the serviceable life of those buildings as far as they possibly can. We're also working to decrease our overall facilities footprint. We are moving out of any facilities that we have been leasing, and we are trying to only be in our own facilities, and we're also looking at selling or demolishing underutilized buildings. Like I said, we have this backlog based on the extended backlog based on declining budgets over the years. And it really translates into attention. Unintentionally, we've had unplanned closures at times. It directly translates to our students, our academic halls, our administrative buildings, our residence halls. These have all, we've ended up with shortages that weren't expected because of this. And without serious attention, we can presume that that may continue to happen. I don't think I've really spoken what our facility types are, and I just want to go back and highlight that that is anything from a residential housing, our academic buildings, which is classes and laboratories, but it's also our administrative offices. And then we even have things like our career and technical centers that are not potentially on our campuses, but elsewhere in town that we work in partnership with other groups. So that's our 394 facilities cover all of that, an umbrella of all of those pieces. And we can say that our capacity right now for expending deferred maintenance dollars, we have the capacity to spend and fix up to about $50 million a year in our facilities based on the time it takes to plan and turn around a project. So I'll move on to the next slide, and we'll look a little bit at our historical deferred maintenance budgets. Here you can see a couple of different factors. I want to bring your attention to the green line, the middle of the screen, which flatlines. That's our historical average for our UA request for deferred maintenance. The red line is where it has been starting in 2007 and going up through FY23. You can see it's got an upward trajectory, really taking off around FY15. That happens to coincide with the dark blue state appropriations going down. We were receiving on and off about $50 million a year for a significant period of time. And as we saw those numbers go down, we turned around from about an $800 million deferred backlog to 1.5. And I think that maybe is a direct response to a question asked earlier about what is the missed opportunity by not funding right away? Do we see those numbers go up? And I will let you defer from this photo what you will, take what you will, but we certainly find that consistent funding of our deferred maintenance has helped us flatline, and it would take about $50 million a year to get us back to flatlining and maybe even potentially decreasing with knowing that we're selling off some of our facilities. But short of that, we can anticipate a continued rise in backlog.
Representative Josephson.
I want to make sure on page 2, the last bullet, that there's clarity about that bullet point. One reading of this could be that internally the university within a couple of years will have the resources on its own, essentially, to provide itself with 35 to 50 million a year. But that isn't what you're intending to say there, right?
Through the chair, I would actually like to call on Director Kreckenberg to clarify that point. If we may.
Director Kreckenberg, can you please put yourself on the record?
Through the chair, Representative Josephson, so for the record, it's Alicia Kruckenberg, the Director of Strategy, Plan, and Budget for the university. So what we mean by that statement is we would be able to basically put $35 to $50 million of funding to execute projects. So if we were given that amount of funding from the state, we would be able to execute on that funding within a few years of right now we don't have necessarily the people to actually execute that much money. Does that clear that up?
Very well. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Chair Edgman. Through the chair to Ms. Perman. So just out of curiosity, a couple observations. Even going back to FY07 to FY11, inconsistency in appropriations typically for deferred maintenance isn't, like, in my opinion, the best way to kind of resolve the problem. So a question on that. I mean, it's before my time, obviously, but do you know why the appropriations from the state were inconsistent that far back?
Through the chair to Representative Stapp, that is also before my time, and I think Director Kruckenberg may also be able to elaborate on that.
So again, this is Alicia Kruckenberg from the university. So through the chair, Representative Stapp, I can't answer that specifically. There were periods of time when, you know, the legislature or the governor, you know, was more generous with deferred maintenance for not only the university but other, you know, other state agencies. So I would suspect that it had more to do with the overall finances of the state, less so about the university or any other state agency. Does that help?
Follow up.
Thank you. Thank you, Director. Through the chair to Ms. Perman. So the previous presenter had a methodology in which they ranked these kind of deferred maintenance projects through kind of a complicated methodology. I'm curious if the university has any comparable system in which we go kind of utilize the same principles, right, to be able to kind of get us back on the track. Obviously, our objective would be to kind of right the ship, so to speak. So,
through the chair to Rep. Stapp, I certainly don't want to utilize Director Kruckenberg, so I'm going to take a first stab at this, but I think it's appropriate that she fills in the blanks that I might have here. It is my understanding that our individual universities forward their priority requests to us. That goes to our Office of Strategy, Planning, and Budget, who then work with President Pitney and then to create this priority list, which then is forwarded to the Board of Directors for review, for feedback, and then is brought back in-house, and we put together this final request for you. I would like to get some more feedback from Director Kruckenberg to clean up the details there.
Thank you. Yes, again, Alicia Kruckenberg, Director of Strategy, Plan, and Budget. I'm not sure if we have to do this every time, but I guess I will for formality. That is correct. Each university has a robust process for which the chancellor of each university's staff puts together their prioritized list of deferred maintenance projects, which then are brought up to the system office where they are, again, prioritize then across the university system. So if you wanted more specifics about how each university does it, I would suggest that you speak to the directors for the facilities for each of the universities that are also online.
Thank you, Director, and Ms. Portman.
And thank you, Ms. Kruckenberg, for bringing up the point about having to identify yourself every time you speak. It is a little bit cumbersome, admittedly, but it is really handy for the recording staff later on when the meetings are transcribed and actually put into writing. So really appreciate your cooperation as well as everyone else's. Co-Chair Johnson, did you have your hand raised?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I don't want to be getting ahead of things, but in the folder there's a list of deferred maintenance items, and I was just wondering if those are in order of priority for the university.
Through the chair to co-chair Delana Johnson. Yes, those are in order of priority.
Thank you.
Back to Sarah Perman. I'm going to move on to slide four here and just talk really briefly about our capital budget as a whole. Separate from today, offices have been distributed a book put together by the university. It's called our Red Book. It's essentially a cheat sheet which has information on our operating budget, our capital budget, including our deferred maintenance, and then the respective details of each of that. In that book is the list of deferred maintenance and priority that Co-Chair Johnson just mentioned. And really briefly, I'll just take you through the high-level priorities of that as we go into deferred maintenance. This priority list was put together by our office with the feedback and guidance of the Board of Regents. And with the guidance of the Board of Regents, we have identified that we've got $17.5 million immediate and priority needs for UAA. That's our number one deferred maintenance, and that is for a four building system for the Wendy Williamson Auditorium, Professional Services Building, Professional Sciences Building, the Social Sciences Building, and the Consortium Library, and that's for heating systems and electrical safety upgrades. Separate from that piece, the other two priorities across the board for our capital are some facilities modernization, which gets us up to speed with WAMI and helps us increase our capacity. And then I will also just talk as we go here through here about an additional $54.8 million in deferred maintenance, which is cross campuses and cross universities. Moving on to slide five, we're seeing our first bullet point here, talking a little more about that $17.5 million deferred maintenance request for UAA. Like I said, that is about our heating system. Heating systems, it's replacing boilers, it's replacing fin tubes, it's replacing the water piping in various buildings, as well as replacing the HVAC system, which is 48 years old, in the central core of the Consortium Library building. Those are beyond useful life, and we're seeing a high risk of failure there. The other three members that are on this, are three components on this page, I'm only going to briefly touch on because they're not deferred maintenance, and I want to move on to that. Like I said, we're talking about $2 million for WAMI renovations in one of our buildings, and that's a capital request. And then we've got two other requests, which are actually not state dollars at all. One's a federal receipt for receiving $6 million for an Alaska Leaders Archive, and then $2.5 million receipts for the Fairbanks North Slope Borough for child care facilities on a UA building, at a UAA building, UAF building, excuse me. Okay, so at that point, I want to dive a little bit more into our deferred maintenance projects, and I talked about our UAA project of $17.5 million. These are our next two big pieces broken out by UAS and UAF. We've got a $3.6 million deferred maintenance for UAS, which consists of the Technical Education Center here down by Harris Way, by Harris Harbor, as well as the Sitka Hangar and the Alaska Maritime Training Center in Ketchikan. All three of those are in desperate need of roof replacements. We're seeing structural problems at this point based on the necessity of roof repairs. And then we've got $11.3 million at UAF, which includes paddy pool replacements. It's anything from refinishing the surfaces to doing the electrical, repairing the pool vessel itself. That's, you know, not necessarily the exterior of the building, but the actual body with which the water sits, as well as the bleachers, the lighting, and then doing everything we can to bring it into code compliance, which is Title IX. That's safety compliances, that's electrical compliances. And then we've also got campus-wide things like replacing 23 fire alarm systems and various other electrical safety components throughout the university. And I don't know, I apologize, this slide deck was pulled from a similar presentation last week in the other body, and we talk a little bit about facility modernization, which I think somewhat falls into this, but I would like the guidance of the chair, whether you'd like us to talk about facility modernization as well, or if we should just only talk about the, you know, renewal and repurposing and other deferred maintenance at this point.
Well, I think we've got the time. I don't see any reason that we shouldn't.
Okay.
And if it gets a little long in the tooth, we might ask you to summarize things, but we should go forward.
And if I'm not mistaken, this is either the last or the second to last slide, so hopefully I'm not too long in the tooth. Through the chair, once again, this is Sarah Perman on the record from the university. Talking about our facility modernization, we just talked about the backlog of pieces that we want to get renewed, repurposed for safety, et cetera, reasons. And then in addition to that, we are looking at a couple of other facility modernizations. These come from a perspective of trying to increase student enrollment, increase and boost the workforce, and attract more, potentially, predominantly, excuse me, attract more students and increase enrollment at the UA campuses and universities. So our first one with this goes a little bit hand in hand with our WAMI expansion that we were talking about before. This is from the College of Health, and they're asking for $8 million to modernize, to repurpose the Sally Mansarood Hall, which is at UAA, and turn that into simulation laboratories and other hands-on training facilities for nurses, medical techs, and there's quite a few different health technicians, health-related categories that come from that, but that would be to not only redo that and build classrooms there, but then translate over the learning commons that are currently there over to our East Campus, which is the Consortium Library. And then up at UAF, we're taking our Lola Tilly Commons, which is on our main drive as you come into town, and we're focusing on really renewing that from a public perspective, making the university more accessible not only to our students but to our general public. It's one of the most accessible buildings. It's renovating it to bring it up to standards expected by students in 2023. We certainly have to compete with all these other universities to make sure that we're attractive in that sense, but it's also making it a public-facing institution where we can host events, et cetera, that are welcoming to the community. And then last but not least is $1 million for UAS Natural Sciences. We currently have a facility that's out near Engineer cutoff here in UA or in Juneau, excuse me, and that facility currently is underutilized and partially leased out. It's underutilized because of location, because of outdated facilities and amenities. And it would this $1 million would be to relocate all the laboratories that are in there, the programs that are in there, over to a new building which is under construction now near Off Bay, across from Off Lake. That's our NSRL, Natural Science Research Laboratory. And this particularly $1 million would be to relocate all the facilities, the components of the facility, over to that new building.
Right, Representative Hannon and Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Chair Edgman. Through the chair, Ms. Pearman, I have questions on two of these. The first one, the UA Workforce Sally Mansarood Hall, is that the same facility that the WAMI lab for $2 million is being built into? And if it's so that building in total needs $10 million to modernize it for not just WAMI for $2 million, but other critical health things like training lab for nurses. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, to Representative Hannon, this is Sarah Perman yet again. That is correct. The Sally Mansarood Hall has been identified from the College of Health as the primary hub for which we would like to do all of our medical-related trainings. So that is not only three different labs and associated simulation rooms for the WAMI program for our pre-doctorate, doctorate students, but also an additional three facilities for our nurses, as well as simulation rooms, as well as debriefing rooms. So that's all in one facility. I believe that the intent is to make it so that West Campus is much more of our College of Health hub, and then East Campus, where the Consortium Library is, that's much more of our academia hub. So we'll be moving the Student Commons, which currently exists in Sally Mansarood, over to the Consortium Library to make room for this College of Health programming. And then in terms of the numbers itself, it's $2 million in UGF for the WAMI program, and then It's 5.75 in UGF for the nursing. The additional 2.25 is in DGF funds. So it's not quite 8 million in UGF.
So follow-up. So the 8 million includes the 2 million for WAMI or does not include the 2 million for WAMI?
Through the chair to Representative Hanum, I apologize for not clarifying that the first time. It's separate from.
Okay. Right. So, and then my second on the bottom one, the UAS Natural Sciences Building. Are we talking about the old NOAA facility as the research lab that we're trying to get out of? When NOAA rebuilt the Ted Stevens NOAA facility further out, UAS acquired the NOAA lab location, but it's a really antiquated building. And is that the one we're moving people out of?
Through the chair to Representative Hannon, at the risk of putting my foot in my mouth, I am going to defer to Nathan Lay with UAS Facilities and Services.
Yes, this is Nathan Lay, UAS Facility Services. Through the chair, no, the old NOAA building, we tore that down a couple of years ago, and we are now building a new building in that spot. We did a value engineering, and it was cheaper to build a new building than try to bring the old building up to current standards. This $1 million is actually to help move one lab out of the old NSRL building, which is over by the city bus barn. It's the old DEC building. And it's going to go into the Anderson building, which is the existing building right next to the new building that's put on there. And the reason that we're doing that is because it's a high technical lab and it requires special ventilation. And the whole building has to have that. And so the Anderson building already has that type of ventilation system. And so we're saving money by not having to move it into the new building, because if we did that, then that whole ventilation system and the whole building envelope would have to be upgraded. And so this is money to move the lab from the NSRL into the Anderson building, and it's going into the old scuba locker. And well, most of the money is to help us build a parking lot for the NSRL building. You know, we want to get rid of the NSRL building. That way, when we have the new building online and we get rid of the old NSRL building, we will actually be reducing our square footage, which is, you know, greatly helps in operations and maintenance and our deferred backlog. Any other question on that one?
Through the chair, thank you. I just, I know we name them all and they have names, but like many of us, I know them by landmarks. So as soon as you said the bus barn building, I know exactly what we're talking about. That's what I needed to know. Thank you.
Representative Stapp.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Through the chair to Ms. Perman. So being a proud interior resident, I always try to attempt to be non-biased when we talk about our different university systems in the state, but I couldn't help but hearing some words that caught my attention with the UAA heating project, one of the capital requests here a couple of slides back. So in my mind, I heard heating system from the 1970s, catastrophic failure. And in Fairbanks, all the catastrophic failures I ever incur are always at 4 a.m. on a Saturday. So my the image I had in my brain was fall semester during finals week, you have a catastrophic failure in four facilities that house the most students in the state at UAA's campus. So I was curious maybe if you had anyone who would want to speak to that line item and how kind of critical it is. Either yourself or someone online. Thank you.
Through the chair. Thank you, Representative Stepp. That's a wonderful question. I am going to pass this off to Chris McConnell with UAA, who will be able to shed some more light on that particular line item.
Thank you. For the record, this is Christopher McConnell, and I serve as the Director of Facilities Planning and Construction for the University of Alaska Anchorage. And so when they, yeah, absolutely. I think the question is well pointed. Thank you. These are very critical facilities that support multiple programs across our campus. PSB and Windy are integrated. PSB has supports a lot lot of College of Health programs, including the Dean's Office, behavioral health programs, as well as our human performance labs and things of that nature in that space. We are at risk consistently of system failures, and we have them on a recurrent basis. Currently, I think we do track these, and I can report back with specifics. I apologize, I don't have them off the top of my head, but we're tracking close to 2 to 3 million in unplanned failures a year. So these are reactive issues that we are trying to triage the best we can with our incredible maintenance and operations staff. But we have had mid-semester air handler failures. We've had sprinkler systems break and displace classes. We've had elevators come down in recent history. We've had failures at our administrative building where we had a fire in an electrical room, the main electrical room, and we had to displace and compress and reallocate. And these are occurring, as the data has suggested, has been reported. It is becoming more and more frequent, particularly with our older facilities. But as our newer spaces continue to age over time, they'll start to come due. And these items will, frankly, stack against us and work against us. So these are very critical projects and strategic projects. I would also like to highlight that we're trying to be creative with how we advocate for these efforts, like this project in particular. We've presented to you in prior years, and we have forecasted, we try and couple these with high ROI type investments. So while we're doing boilers and air handler systems, we're trying to grab lighting and do mechanical control upgrades so we can reduce operating costs to promote capital cost avoidance. So this reactive issue that you bring up as a concern. And we've estimated, at least when we first looked at this, close to $300,000 a year in annual savings if we can get this project across the finish line. So those are some of the strategies. But it is critical, and we are at risk of having the midnight, mid-semester, mid-winter call and having to strategize how we respond quickly to that. And we are we continue to look at contingency planning in that regards. Hopefully that answers your question. Happy to provide additional clarification.
Follow up? Representative Josephson.
I think that through the chair, Mr. Chairman, and my colleagues, we need to find a way to support the university, obviously, and strategize how to convince the administration to accept these appropriations. I mean, that's. You know, generally these conversations don't occur so publicly, but as I noted earlier, we can make these appropriations. I just don't know the stick, and I don't know how to help you with that. But I'm here to help. If there's anything from the university I can do, thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Through the chair, I would like to ask the former speaker who just answered about questions related to immediate emergencies with the heating system. What I think I heard, Chair, was that there have been, throughout the previous recent years, emergencies costing up to a couple of $1 million each year. And I think if we're looking at a $17.5 million expenditure, and if this has taken place several times, I wondered if maybe we could get some accounting on that, if possible, from the university to have a sense of how much money we've spent. Just to the point of Representative Josephson, if we could maybe come up with some ways of better articulating the cause and the need to make these expenditures happen this year.
Well, we were talking at the break how the term deferred maintenance, especially when you sort of bridge the different categories in the state of everything from the university to state agencies to school districts, how in some respects it's a term of art more than a term of science, or maybe a combination of both. I think the request is very valid, but I'm kind of wondering if we're sort of crossing over between deferred maintenance to modernization to actual outright capital project
request. Mm-hmm. But certainly, certainly that that should come before the committee at some point.
Through the chair, I don't know if there are follow-up questions, but I just want to say thank you so far to the members for highlighting concerns and perspectives. I really appreciate your voices in the room.
All right. Any follow-up questions or comments? Not seeing any Representative Josephson.
I know we have their capital team here, but since we have the liaison here, entirely, of course, at the co-chair's discretion, I would like to hear from the university at some point on its salary negotiations with its professors and get a sense of whether they're paid in a way that makes them feel appreciated and want to stay on the campuses. Again, if there's interest in from the co-chairs in calendaring a discussion about that, that would be appreciated.
Just a quick sidebar with operating budget co-chair. Did you want to address that just in the context of maybe a later hearing or certainly a separate request from today's agenda?
Thank you, Mr. Co-chair. We will, I mean, we're still working on the schedule and we have to kind of take a look at what we have before us and what kind of, if there's any kind of pressure on it. But I'll keep that in mind that's something that you would like to do.
All right, I think that brings us to the end of today's agenda. And with that, thank you, Ms. Perman, for coming forward. And thank you to everyone online as well for participating in today's meeting. Our next scheduled meeting is scheduled for tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. Thursday, where we will receive an overview of the governor's FY23 supplemental budget from Neil Steininger, Director of the Office of Management and Budget. I will turn the gavel over at that point to Co-Chair Johnson. And with that, not seeing any further business coming before the committee, we are adjourned at exactly 3 p.m.